American Graffiti. Where were you in 62?
That special one and jump into your candy-colored custom or your screaming machine, cruise downtown and catch American Graffiti.
American Graffiti?
Baby, what's that?
It's a movie.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Go back in time.
Where were you in 62?
Is that you in that beautiful car? Jeez, what a waste of machinery.
Welcome back to the Mad About Movies VIP Club. Now here's one of your hosts, Kent, Brian, or Richard.
What is up, man fam? Welcome to the VIP Bar Club Grill Lounge, Mel's Diner. Driving? Mel's driving? Mel's driving. Classic car construction. Whoa. and kind
of a gas monkey situation.
We do. Yeah, we got to
get like more of, like, cool.
Got a whole bunch of guys over here in white t-shirts with cigarettes rolled up into the sleeves.
Uh-huh.
That's when men were men.
Orange County Choppers.
Yeah. we opened one of those.
That's when probably guys, knew cable wasn't for the long haul. You know, when those shows were really doing well.
Right. Yeah. Between that and what's the the Louisiana the camp
the Bayou guys? All right. Yeah.
Duck Dynasty.
There we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Between that, like Pawn Stars and, you know, Storage
Boo-Boo
Wars
too,
and
right?
I'm guilty of watching some Storage Wars. I think about doing storage auctions every day, to be honest with you guys. It's something that sticks in my brain pretty hard, but still not great
TV. I don't
know
if you guys have ever seen, or you didn't have seen this new John Wilson season, but he's walking, I think it's somewhere in New York, and interviews this guy. Like, he's like, hey, can I talk to you for a second? He talks to him, he's talking about like what it's like to live in this neighborhood, New York. And he's like, what are you watching? He's like, Ice Road Truckers. Ice Road Truckers. It's just the funniest throwaway. It's like, of all the things, this guy is like posted up watching Ice Road Truckers. And like, man, that is a show that I am shocked as an audience. Watching Ice Road Truckers.
Here's a good one. I have a friend. You have both met him, but I won't call him out. You can ask me after the pod if you want. But one time he was watching, it wasn't Ice Road Truckers, but it was one of those ones like Alaskan State Trooper kind of, you know, the Wild of Alaska,
right,
and whatever.
Right.
And he's like hungover on a Sunday and he's watching it, and they're arresting this guy, and he's like, oh, that's my dad. It was just his dad getting arrested on, like, whatever that Alaskan Run from the Law Alaska show was, for like a ton of whatever drunken disorderlies across the state or something. Like, cool. That feels good.
Whoopsie.
I'm all for a good, some junk TV, but some of it is like, what? It's amazing.
I just don't know how there's this much of it, I think, is where I mean, I watch a ton of HGTV and House Hunters and all that stuff. That's not too far off of all of this, you know. I get it, but
I can't believe there's a pimple popper show that people watch.
Yeah, I just don't understand how there's this much of it. That's the thing. But you know, someone could say the same thing about comic book movies and TV shows and stuff too. I get it. There's a lot of content, I guess, is the point. I don't know how we have so many cable channels anymore. That's really where I feel like, what are we doing here? I don't know how this is. How are these staying in business?
Totally. At this point, I always think that stuff's stupid, and then I'm always like, my favorite hobby is for like 9 hours straight watching guys throw a ball around a field or kick a ball or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
With arbitrary rules that don't matter.
Right.
So
yeah,
I can't really judge.
We're not watching people
get
zits popped.
That I draw the line at. You should be on some sort of watch list if you're watching one of these things. I feel
what's weirder, honestly, watching that and pleasuring yourself, or watching that and not? Because at least those guys, you know, you got a thing, right? Like it's that's the, like that was kind of put on you.
The for same whatever, watch list, regardless.
Whatever happened to you in your youth, like you got that's your thing. You got to work through. But like just enjoying that, not with trauma, is you know.
It's weird either way. And thanks to Nielsen Data, you're on a watch list. So
I write it in my Nielsen journal.
Honey, get dinner ready. Dr. Pimple Popper is almost on. Yeah,
I know. Like, that's my thing. I'm very sensitive about shows I
can eat dinner to.
Can eat dinner to, yes. Mm-hmm. We watch TV when we eat dinner, which is not great. We probably should break that habit as we have a kid getting older. But
meh.
But but like I'm always like we can be really deep into like a drama or something, and Sarah will be like, "Want to watch that?" I'm like, "I don't," because there's someone that might get their head blown off, and if I'm eating, that ruins it. Yeah. I'm weak about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's when you watch American Choppers. All right, we are talking about American Graffiti. This is a movie turning 50 years old this year.
Wow,
50 years old, but kind of timeless because of its era. Obviously, it's setting in 1962. This is the second George Lucas movie, I believe, after THX 1138. But his first successful movie, and that's a big part of why we're talking about it 50 years on, I think. And sort of it's. Kind of get into at the end here like the legacy that this movie ends up creating and you know what it leads to, but want to get your background both of you. I like when we do we do give or take 52 throwbacks a year. I don't want a huge chunk of those 52 movies to be older movies, to be movies that are older than we are or much older than we are. But I do like when we do this once every other month or so, talk about something that is an older film, because they're not movies that come up in our conversation as much. And for a lot of times, I think these are the movies that we, the three of us, between it, we're more likely to have only seen this a movie that's 50 years old once or twice or not at all, something like that, between the three of us. And so I think sometimes those are the more fun conversations than talking about the movies that we've all seen 100,000 times each. So that's definitely the deal for me. This is a classic movie that I've seen three times, you know, or something like that. It's a movie that I would almost say I have more appreciation for than I do actually enjoy. And I don't know the last time that I sat down and I watched this thing, but I do remember this being a player in my household, like for my dad. And it's, I really think it's a very well put, really, really good movie that has a great legacy, and I've enjoyed it every time I've watched it. And this was a fun revisit for the first time in, you know, 15 years or something like that. So not a movie I watch a ton, but a movie that I really appreciate and I think has a lot of value. And now Richard will say this movie's dog crap. So Richard, what's your background with
dog American crap? Graffiti? No. It's a much more important movie than it is a good movie, right? Because it's like it launches a lot of stuff, both on in front and behind the camera. It's weird because George Lucas just never did this again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's funny too. I mean, the only movies he directs after this are A New Hope and then the three prequels, and is becomes far more of a technologist, you know, than a filmmaker. Both when he's making movies and when he's not, to good and bad results. Mm-hmm. But so it's a really interesting movie that this kind of like dramedy, you know, it's got this ensemble cast. There are almost no aliens. but yeah, and it's this very kind of grounded thing. It's about a really interesting, I'm always really fat. I think the 50s are oftentimes more interesting than the 60s. The 60s get a lot of the hype, but there's so much interesting real revolution happening in the 50s, but in this kind of subtle way, you know, the invention of the teenager and all these things that are like really just marketing, but change the entire paradigm of how we view American culture. And so things that dwell on that and talk about that are interesting to me. So I like this movie a lot. It's one of my favorites of the era. I think it's really cool. It's other than A New Hope, it's the second best George Lucas movie, so that's great. so as a director. So yeah, it's one I have not revisited in a long time. My first time seeing it, gosh, I don't know. Not too young, but teens. Seen it probably 3 or 4 times. Always like it more than I think I do. And it's fun to see, like, you know, Harrison Ford and Ron Howard and to a lesser extent Dreyfus, you know, at this piece in their career. And also I want to say, I love the kind of French influence of the, like, vignette structure of it. I think it's really cool. It doesn't have to do that. That's very Lucas-y, like that whole era of like super literate film students of that time, you know, with Coppola producing this and Lucas making it. But it doesn't come off as pretentious. It comes off as an original way of making this. And I always try to put it in that context of how revolutionary that kind of was for a big kind of American movie, for no pun intended. Totally. So that's my synopsis. Kent, what about you, man?
Yeah, I'm the same. I grew up on this one. It was a big player with my parents. They always would talk about how great it was and all the actors they loved and how it reminded them of their youth and things like that. So, you know, anytime it would come on, they would watch it. So very familiar with it. It was a big Ron Howard guy in our house. He was a big player with not just this, but Happy Days and Andy Griffith were on all the time in my house. So it's another Ron Howard piece of content for you. It's interesting to go back and watch this and to see him and again, Harrison Ford. But to me, this is like the most bearable Richard Dreyfuss performance. Maybe like, I don't know, the youth version of him is actually like, wow, you could see why this guy was getting all these gigs, because I think he's pretty endearing as a youth, but once Jaws comes around and he's just like an old crank for the rest of his career, I think it really soured me on him. Like, I haven't enjoyed him in anything since then, but like the early Dreyfus, like really like Close Encounters is pretty good,
right,
you know?
Right. I think that it wasn't real fast, not to interrupt you, but I think that for Dreyfus, when he's like a kind of a smug 20s Dreyfus, you're like, I freaking hate this guy, but dang, he's good at this. And then by the time he's in his 30s and 40s, you're like, God, I just want to punch him in the face. I just hate this guy so much. He's so he's so insufferable. But yeah, I'm with you. It's like this,
the back
Jaws
of the class
and,
thing. Yeah.
And Close Encounters. It's sort of an enjoyable. You like seeing him suffer in this movie, I think. But he's a good actor. He's very good.
Yeah, he's
at
a buffoon in this,
thing,
and he's hanging out with people that are way cooler than him, and he wants to hang out. He wants to fit in. Maybe it's an endearing character for him to play, or a humbling character for him to play. But I found myself liking him more in this movie than I ever would in anything else. But you're right, Richard. That's what I was going to hit on. Was before Star Wars, George Lucas was like a auteur, like a real artsy filmmaker, and even his USC stuff was so artsy, his THX short film and then that movie and then all, you know, his short films that he made while in film school were so European influenced that they, you know, people like Coppola didn't think he'd ever make it in America because he was too artsy and too out there. And we think of him now as this like the quintessential blockbuster filmmaker, right? But really he started from a place that was just purely experimental. And I think this movie was a response to Coppola seeing THX and was like, dude, you need to make a movie for everyone. This movie's for you and me and nerds, which is great for that. But I don't think you can make a movie for, you know, the average person, people's families, people's moms, right? And so he's like, oh, I think I can. I think I can do that. And did this, obviously inspired by his upbringing. But what I love about it is that it's just a hangout movie.
Yeah.
At the end of the day. And this we've seen this trope repeated. I don't know if this was the first to do the trope of it's the last day of school, we got to get one last night in of partying before this is all over, or if that was a cliche he borrowed. I'm sure it probably was, but that's always something that works to me.
Yeah.
And a movie like this, sure, it was nostalgic at the time, but even more now, because it's just people hanging out with people and there's no internet drama or anything like that going on. And it's just a time that's further and further away as the years go by, was these types of nights. And we had them in high school, Richard, where we'd meet at Whataburger, and then we'd go to the movies, and then we'd drive somewhere else after them. You know, it was like we would cruise kind of around our area and see who we see. We'd see people at stoplights. Oh, come over with us. You know, that type of stuff just is few and far between these days, it feels like, right, with the way people are just connected all the time. And so it's got that nostalgia for it. I've never been somebody who loves the aesthetic of 1950s, early 60s America. I can't stand like the greaser culture. I let the let's go down to the sock hop stuff. I just don't care for it. I've never been drawn to it as like a in movies or Broadway plays or anything like that. And so for me to come away with this movie like, wow, I enjoyed that, is saying a lot, because I just find this entire, I don't know, trope, if you will, like the caricatured version of it, just really cringy most of the time. And so best thing about this movie is the cars, though. I mean, awesome cars. I think Lucas is a big car guy and wanted to really show that off. I'm surprised there's not more. There is that one car chase sequence at the end, but I'm surprised he didn't try to put more hot rodding in this movie than he did.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I think some of that's probably the budget. This is like a $750,000 movie, which it ends up making like $140 globally. So that's one of the most profitable movies of all time, obviously. But like the budget was so low that this movie invented credits, essentially. This is the first movie where anyone who was involved in the cast and crew gets a credit at the end.
Got a back end.
Yeah, because he sort of paid, quote unquote, some of the people in this movie, some of the crew at least, with a credit. I guess up to this point, you'd only see a credit for the head of each department and part of the movie. And instead, this one gets everybody in there. So, I think that's probably some of the reason why you don't get more races and hot rotting and all that kind of stuff, Kent.
Makes sense.
This is a really interesting movie because, and for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons being because Lucas never does this again, as you mentioned, Richard. I would say that it's because he can't. I think this is such an autobiographical movie for him, or like sort of a fantastical version of an autobiographical film, kind of. And I'm not sure that he could. I'm not sure that he had anything else to draw on for this kind of movie. But then also, obviously, Star Wars comes out and it changes everything, and he becomes a completely different kind of. He becomes a producer, not a filmmaker.
I was thinking this in the prep for the show, Brian. Do you think if he never got the merchandising rights to Star Wars, that would have changed his entire career? I think that's what kept him from making movies. Was he was making so much money on just the IP of Star Wars, aside from the movies. It's like, oh, I'm so rich, I don't have to. But if he didn't have that money, I think creatively he would still be striving for that.
I think that that's possible, but the counter argument to that is this movie made him an overnight multimillionaire, and because he got a huge chunk of the pot on this because it cost nothing to make, and he ended up making a pretty good deal with Universal to get it made.
And finance Star Wars, basically, right?
Yes. At the end of the day, he comes out of this movie with the money that he uses to finance Star Wars, and the money that he uses to start the companies that became
ILM,
Lucasfilm, Skywalker Sound, ILM, and what became Pixar? What was it called?
It was called Pixar originally.
It was called something else before he sold it to Jobs. It was like Star Wars Creative or something like that. He comes out of this with so much money that I don't know, Kent. I don't know if Star Wars doesn't happen, or if Star Wars bombed the way that they thought that it was going to bomb. I think that he probably has made enough money out of this that it just takes a long... Maybe it just rolls directly into Indiana Jones, and that becomes the legacy instead of Star Wars.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't think that he... I think that he was much more inclined to become an entrepreneur and a producer and a sort of a futurist and invested in the technology side of things than
he
was...
The graphics group, Brian, by the way.
There it is. Thank you. Than he was in becoming a director, a filmmaker, like this. I think that that's kind of the path he always would have ended up on. There probably, though, would be more credits in there. You know, it's instead of focusing the rest of his life essentially film wise on Star Wars, with a few writing credits here and there. Otherwise, I think that maybe you get a few more movies in the late 70s and early 80s that he's the director of, you know, but I think this is kind of where he always ends up, is more on the producing and technology side of things. But it would be very interesting to go back and look at and read about the movie Bratz, you know, with him and Spielberg and Coppola and De Palma and Scorsese, and to see, like, you're exactly right, Kent, that they kind of thought, hey, dude, you're too much of an auteur. This is not going to work for American audiences and stuff. That is a crazy thing to think about when you think about the person that essentially invents summer blockbusters and whatnot. It's
honestly amazing that ever worked, because that was a super weird idea.
Yeah.
It just happened to be one that everybody reacted to, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, well, after American Graffiti, I'm gonna have this one with this talking ape and these laser swords. It's like, okay, you can't just go straight back to which he did, and it worked. He's like, no, trust me on this one. Yeah, you know, just trust me.
It would be interesting to see the world where Spielberg doesn't do Jaws and Lucas doesn't do Star Wars, and what would have happened for those guys. But I do think that this was a big enough hit. I mean, I always think of Jaws and Star Wars as like this was where summer blockbuster started. But really, this was sort of the precursor to that. I mean, this is a huge, huge movie on a tiny, tiny budget. And again, it makes him very rich very quickly. And that's what starts, I think, a lot of these. I think that's the precursor that matters for Jaws and Star Wars and E.T. and all of those movies. Richard, I'm with you, and I can't really put my finger on why this is, because I hate greaser culture. I hate Grease more than anything. Maybe that's the main reason that I hate that sort of stuff. Yeah. I don't care for that stuff, and I'm not a car guy. I don't really care very much about cars either, but there is something about mid to late 50s into like the around this time, you know, 62, 63, that I do find really appealing on film and interesting history wise, more so than the mid to late 60s and early 70s, and I think more so than, at least with the 40s, I think it's more just like we get that so much in history class and stuff like that. Like it's a hit pretty heavily up to that point. And at least with my awful public school education, it kind of feels like the 50s is just kind of, I'm not really talking about that. We got to jump from World War II to the Soviets, essentially, like the Cold War, and really get into JFK and Vietnam and all these sort of things. I don't know why this era appeals to me on film or in history, but it really does. And I don't know. I'm watching this movie last night, and I love the neon, and I like the concept of, like you said, Kent, like the hangout movie, and we're just going to get in our cars and go. And
the drive-ins are great. I mean, Mel's drive-in is a great spot, and that's such, I mean, think about how many nights we went to Sonic as a youth. I mean, I feel like that concept has played really, really well for generations.
And I still have that a little bit. Like, I mean, if, you know, I'm not a big people person. I'm pretty introverted. If we go out and we get a drink, I'm pretty quick to be like, all right, where are we going next? You know? And it's just, I think it's a little bit of that was something that I loved in high school and college, is just like keeping the night going and moving from place to place. And obviously, you know, our version of of drifting was quite a bit different in the, you know, for me, the late 90s and early 2000s, and you guys the early to mid 2000s mostly. But there's something very appealing about, still to me at 40, of this kind of this bit. I don't know, Richard, do you have any insight on like what is it about this time period that appeals to you? And I don't know, maybe that helps me figure it out myself.
It's the, you know, when you talk about it's a lot of the war bonds coming out, you know, it's like a lot of things. We're building a superpower in the 50s. We now have this nuclear bomb. We also saw that with Oppenheimer. And there's some kind of like slow rebuild in the late 40s as we all, the world, not just America, kind of comes to grips with the last, you know, 10 years. And then 50 is this incredible time. You know, we build the interstate system and car culture becomes a thing. And like
suburban life. Yeah.
It used to, and the idea that you would be educated to 18 becomes much more of a norm. This was not necessarily the thing for, you know, people outside of it. So thus then you had this, it used to be you became 12, 13, and then you became some version of an adult. And now there was this whole other thing, the teenager that, you know, people figured out, Coca-Cola and rock and roll and all this stuff, figured these are people that actually have money in their pockets and are the audience and tastemakers for a lot of things. So you have a lot of things around youth culture. It seems old timey to us, things like greaser culture and stuff, but this is like really, you know, dads that were born in the 20s really hated this, you know? And so, it's in, and you have this continual time of growth of the baby boom. The Halberstam book, the 50s, is really, really great on this. I mean, this is a great time of prosperity in America where everything, you know, kind of was going, not for all people, certainly not for people of color, things like that. But I mean, for, you know, for a lot of middle America, a time where like the prices of houses and the prices of stuff fit salaries, right? And so all of a sudden you could build a life, and there was a celebration of that and a change in that and all these different things that happen, which of course gets then, you know, which the 50s really go from like 1954 to 1965, and then in the late 60s, early 70s, that all gets torn down. And but it's a time of a lot of building and prosperity that we still enjoy to this day, like the aforementioned interstates, and the idea of getting in your car, you know, this movie's about, and maybe just going out and cruising to a few places in town, but also maybe going four towns over,
right.
You know, and that's all new, you know, other than a train trip or things like that. So it's a whole new America that people find themselves in the 50s. And it's I think a time of there's a lot of bad stuff that happens, but a time of general cultural prosperity and innocence that I think is interesting to set films in.
That's a very good summation.
Man, that was excellent. That was like a history lesson. Yeah. I love that.
That's maybe the best podcasting we've ever done.
That was the best Richard Barton two and a half minutes
yeah.
in the history of MAM.
Thanks, guys. Yeah.
It's in the podcast now. That was awesome. I love that. Seriously, like I genuinely, that kind of puts into perspective the vibe that I get when I watch one of these movies. I think the soundtrack's great too. The 50s music, 60s music too, but really 50s is never something I'm going to pull up on my Spotify ever. I'm never going to be like, yeah, it's time to, I'm going to get some Chuck Berry going here. But I always love it when it pops up in a movie. And this, obviously, this is a, that's a huge part of this thing. This is originally a movie that started at United Artists and got turned down, ended up at Universal. And a big part of the reason why was the original script. He wrote it essentially with needle drops written into the script and had like 80 songs that he wanted to use. And United Artists was like, we can't afford that. We can't get all of these, all the licensing on this thing. So it ends up at like something like 40, 45 songs for the actual movie and no Elvis. There's no Elvis in this movie because they couldn't afford, any Elvis songs. But the soundtrack costs like $90K out of their $750,000 budget. And is also the reason why there's no score and, to where they have to use these songs as the score essentially because they didn't have any more any money left over to do a score. And I think that that makes the movie that much better. It works. Some movies really need a score. I would say most movies really need a score. This is one that having it scored by the songs that would have been on the radio, it makes the movie better. And I love that part. I mean, there's a little bit of happy accident there maybe of just, well, we don't have any money left over, but that turned out to be the best thing possible, I think, for the movie. I love this music in a movie or, you know, a TV show or something like that much more than I do. Let me pop on the record here, I think, and enjoy that quite a bit about this. And the other thing too, Kent, this may be more for you, Wolfman Jack.
Yeah, it was cool.
I love that, dude. I love that concept of the, you know, the AM radio and getting actual Wolfman Jack in this movie in a cameo appearance, kind of, which is one of the better scenes in the movie, I think. And but just the concept of all of these people driving around this little town and they're all listening to Wolfman Jack, I love. I think that's a really fun, sort of appealing little note here.
Apparently he wanted to do a documentary on Wolfman Jack instead of this, but he said no, which led him to doing this. I didn't notice it until this last rewatch that, man, that character of Philip Seymour Hoffman in Almost Famous feels inspired by that role in this, doesn't it?
Sure,
like the kind of overarching voice of reason for the youth of the time, right? This kind of voice, you know, person who you don't really have a face to, this voice you've been reading for so long and trusting in. I really enjoyed that. And I wanted to ask you guys this because it seems like there's a definitive movie in this style every decade or generation.
Sure.
I feel like it's this for the 70s. For the 80s, it's probably The Breakfast Club. For the 90s, it's probably Dazed and Confused.
Yeah.
2000s, Superbad, maybe. 2010s, I don't know, Lady Bird, maybe something like that. There hasn't really been one for our youth, though. A movie that really just nails the mid-aughts aesthetic and what we grew up in. I feel like that's still coming. Like, there's going to be a Dazed and Confused about 2004. Sure.
Yeah.
The post 9/11 youth of America. And I'm excited to see who does it because it's
Boyhood had some
ripe
of that,
on
maybe?
The pine. Boyhood a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. And yeah, Superbad has it on the comedian comic part of it, but you're right, there's not like the real kind of weighty one.
Can't Hardly Wait is
yeah
the movie that comes closest, I think, but it's it's not a...
Days of Confused came out in the 90s, but it's talking about the 70s, so you're right. Can't Hardly Wait's probably more 90s culture.
Yeah, yeah, for 90s, for sure.
The difference being that it happened in the moment. I think Can't Hardly Wait came out in 98 or 99. American Pie, same thing, but the problem, the difference between... And why, I mean, I agree with you. The difference between Days of Confused and American Graffiti, that kind of movie, and I would even put Superbad in that, despite what I'm about to say. But the difference between that and
like gross out comedy and not.
Yeah, right. Can't Hardly Wait's too silly, and and it is supposed to be a comedy, or maybe even a teen rom-com if you want to go that direction, more so than a slice of Americana, essentially, which is what Days and Confused and American Graffiti are. I think Superbad did a much better job of capturing the moment than Can't Hardly Wait did. Superbad felt like a movie that was written... I'm older than you guys. I was like out of college when Superbad came out, but Superbad felt like a movie that was written by somebody who had just graduated from college and was like in this, like... within the last 4 years, whereas Can't Hardly Wait feels like a movie written by adults about teenagers today.
There's like a real pre 9/11 thing that Can't Hardly Wait, which like Superbad doesn't address 9/11, but there's something about that, like that weird linchpin of culture that like the tone got different and got a little more biting and sarcastic. And I always say this about Superbad. It's like, that's the movie, at least for a certain generation, it may be different now, but that's the movie that best, to your point, it replicates how kids talk. They're not that vulgar always. Sometimes they are. They're not that funny, but there's a rhythm to that.
The way they rib each other.
Authentic. Concept. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The way it's, that's how dudes have, when, at least when I was, that's how we talked to each other. And there was, it nailed that rhythm. Right. And then, you know, the guitar parts and the flourishes might be obviously A, extremely vulgar, but B, written by comedy writers, but the bass line and drums are very true.
Yeah.
I think what's great about this movie too is George Lucas kind of wrote himself into three roles of it, right? The Ron Howard role, the Dreyfus role, and then like the nerd kid role.
Yeah.
I like that too, that there's these distinct different personalities, and so it gives the audience, male or female, somebody to relate to in the movie, or like, oh, that was my experience. You know, I remember me and my girlfriend broke up when I went to college, or oh no, we stayed together. Or I remember wanting to hang out with the cool kids, and when I got my chance, I blew it. Or I remember being by myself and I hung out with this incredibly beautiful girl and none of my friends believe me, you know, that kind of thing.
We still don't.
Which is, I love that about this. And, you know, it does have that trope of, oh, I knew kids like that in high school. I think everybody does. Yeah. And so it kind of plays into those cliches of the stereotypical kids in high school, but in a really authentic way. I think Ron Howard's probably the best in the movie in terms of I don't know, just a real natural performance. And you can see why he was successful.
Yeah. It's really interesting. This may be the last note I really have on this, but I think I probably fall into this camp myself, assuming that this is the movie that gets Happy Days made for Ron, and it's actually the opposite of that. They had filmed the Happy Days pilot in 72 or 71 and rejected it. They decided they weren't moving forward with it, and then they aired it in as like, here's the pilot, and as part of Love American Style, which is like an anthology show that was on at the time. And Lucas saw that and was like, okay, I want him for this movie. And then after the success of this movie, then CBS ends up saying, all right, let's revisit this thing, kind of bring it back, and added Fonzie based on the greaser character whose name now I'm forgetting here in this one, LeMans, who's really good. John Collier, I think. It was an interesting, cause you're right, Ken. I think Ron Howard's actually really great in this, and he's sort of, you know, he's on the poster and everything. Really, this is much more of Richard Dreyfuss's movie than it is Ron Howard's. Mm-hmm. And I wonder with him too, if this doesn't turn into Happy Days for him, what happens for him as an actor? Does he end up doing more stuff, because once Happy Days comes around and it's pretty much he's done this, he's done Happy Days, he's locked into and this kind of character and this look, and I think he kind of has to go into directing, even if that wasn't going to end up being his thing, because he was going to be very much typecast in that kind of role. But I wonder what happens to him if this
Clint is the, this doesn't becomes turn the star. Into
Happy Days. Yeah. Yeah. Be interesting.
That's a good point. And Harrison Ford's funny when he pops up in this too, for the short time he's in it. It's fun to see him in a really, you know, like his McConaughey moments in Days Confused, this guy just shows up and he's an automatic star. He was a construction worker or whatever he was on the side.
Yeah, carpenter. Yeah, he turned his down originally because they were offering him less than scale, basically. And he's like, I can make more as a carpenter. And so they had to up the pay rate, I think, to $500 a week in order for him to sign on for this little part. And apparently he and a couple of the other guys were drunk the entire shoot and just like causing trouble.
Well, plays it into their character pretty well.
Yeah, it worked out. Worked out.
Well, really well. I have one question for you guys. Please. This is my last thing. Is because, Richard, that was such a important time in American history, what this is playing on. It's such a iconic time with the imagery and everything, with the cars and the drive-ins and all that. It is. This movie's in the National Film Registry, Library of Congress. Is it in there because it's the movie that really just captured that moment the best, or the first? Does that make sense?
Sure.
Like, I feel like whoever makes the movie set in 2003, senior class, and if it's a good movie, like, that's an easy Library of Congress type movie, right? Just because... Sure. It was such an important time for people transitioning in life.
Well, I would say this is like the kind, this is exactly the movie that you're thinking of when you start the Library of Congress, like the National Film Registry or whatever. It's like, this is, yeah, absolutely. This is,
it's got American in the name.
Well, yeah. And it's just like, this is like the perfect movie to put in a time capsule and say, you know, hey, if you want to know what life was like in 1962, here you go. Even though this movie was made in 1973, yeah, it's kind of perfectly designed that way, I think.
There are some movies that are like in there because it's a good movie. And I think this one is more because it is a time capsule of America.
Sure. Yeah. I would say it's a good movie, but I'm with you. And I think capsule. It's probably not a great movie, but it is a great... it's like a great... It's a very important point in the history of film in America, at least. And maybe more so than the movie. Although the movie... was very good. I remember being bored by this when I was a kid, and then as a late teenage, early 20s, like, oh, this is actually a really good movie, and I'm not bored by this at all. When my dad was watching it when I was 9 or whatever, like, Dad, what are we doing? This is a beat down. But it's a very good movie too.
I think Dazed and Confused is a better movie and also funnier.
Totally agree. Yeah.
100%. But because I think in the 50s and 60s, I mean, the kids were so polite. Like, they didn't curse each other out and stuff like the 70s. And I think that culturally it was just way more different.
And to sort of paraphrase a point that I think Richard and I both have sort of made over the years, like, Dazed and Confused had American Graffiti and Fast Times at Ridgemont High and a couple of others to work off of. And I don't think American Graffiti did. It's the Hendrix thing or the Bob Dylan thing, whatever. It's like, there's probably been better guitar players than Jimi Hendrix. This is sort of Richard's point in the past that I'm poorly paraphrasing, but been better guitar players than Jimi Hendrix. But, Jimi Hendrix was the first, or Soprano, same thing. Like,
they all got to grow up listening to Jimi Hendrix. Maybe. Yeah,
right. Exactly. But Mad Men had Sopranos to work off of, and Sopranos had,
that's a good point,
you know, X-Files or whatever to work off of. So it's a little bit different.
How nervous was Spielberg though when this came out?
Yeah.
It's like, oh God, this guy is going to be me. Like, he was like, I got to do something incredible now. Like, it put pressure on all his I mean, Coppola had The Godfather the year before this, right, so he was fine, right. But I bet Spielberg was freaking out, like, oh man, I need to do more than Duel, you know, or whatever he was doing at this time.
Sure, yeah. I've said before, I'm not very interested in biopics. I would be very interested in the Movie Brats biopic or series. Or there was a podcast series, I think, that Hollywood Reporter did a few years ago that was based on this. It was overproduced. It like had a lot of fake quotes, reading and stuff. Like, it was almost a cast, and I did not. That wasn't what I was wanting. I think you could do a really interesting 6-part.
I wanted to
Netflix
do it
series on these but guys
with like a horny Jerry West type twist.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Where and make like, a lot of really, really obvious political points that you are actually super subtle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you read the book, the chapter?
Bogdanovich is just really horny in it.
Have you read the chapter in Tarantino's book about this yet?
I haven't. No, I need to get this book. I need to get on this thing.
Yeah.
Let Tarantino direct the documentary about the Movie Brats. He puts De Palma in there too. Mm-hmm. And Bogdanovich.
De Palma was sort of one of the guys. Yeah.
Hearing Tarantino talk De Palma is
That's
pretty awesome. Yeah, he's obsessed with De Palma. And I agree with you. This is such an interesting time from 73 to 77. It's what those guys, the conversations they were having. And
Everything in American film comes out of this everything, everything. And it's, I don't know, maybe they don't want to talk about it. Maybe that's been pitched 1,000 times in boardrooms. But it seems like an obvious...
You need to do it quick because they're Francis is pretty old. Right. Like you can't do the
they're not,
talk to
they're
him
not
forever.
Young guys. And so all right,
Pierre,
let's grade this and get out of here. I'll give this is a straight A for me. Legacy wise is A++++. I mean, this is a huge this is like a kind of a touchstone moment in American film at the time. But as a movie, just a solid A for me. Richard, what about you?
Same thoughts. So sweet. Moving along. Kat, what about you, man?
Same for me, an A. And what I like about it, too, is it's all at night, basically. I think that works really
love
well
that too.
The way
big
shot
fan
it.
Of that trope. Yeah. Yeah. Same. It's good. All right. Well, thank you for listening and for being here, dear VIPs. This movie's on Netflix, I believe, through the end of August. So if you want to watch it for free, get on that. Well, not for free. I'm sure it's just, you know, part of your...
Included.
Included in your streaming plans. Get on that. Next week, I think we'll be talking about
searching
for Bobby
Fischer.
Yeah, that'll be fun. And the following week, last week of August, will be Disaster Retrospective talking Cutthroat Island, which will be a really fun one, I think, because that movie is terrible. And the legacy of what it did, this is like studio-destroying film. So it'll be fun to talk about. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you at the cinema. Goodbye.